Welcome to Growing Up ATL, where we, the Mayor's ATL Year of the Youth Ambassadors, take the lead in producing and hosting content tailored specifically for the youth by the youth.
Today, we are going to be talking about affordable housing and everything around housing.
Okay, I hope we get some good information because we need to be able to afford housing in Atlanta. Ion, you ready?
Always ready.
All right. And today's topic, affordable housing, you good?
Yes, ready? Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Ms. Kirsten, you got anything?
I'm excited to hear what they have to say because I have questions and I'm hoping that they answer them all.
I'm hoping that they make it plain. Because I know we all know I work in the mayor's office. I'm a senior advisor to the mayor for youth development and education. Kirsten, you are the creative advisor for Year of the Youth. Ion and Kayla, you are youth ambassadors. We hear about affordable housing. We hear these announcements every other week. Lots of great announcements, ribbon cuttings.
Yeah.
What does it mean?
Yeah, you hear kind of like these big buzzwords all the time, and I hope to get into the nitty-gritty of what those really mean.
Mm-hmm. I hope so. And so today we are interviewing Joshua Humphreys. And so Josh works in the mayor's office. He's a senior advisor for housing in the chief policy office to the mayor. And also, I believe we're going to have Terry Lee, who is just the head human in charge of all things housing in Atlanta. But she's with the Atlanta Housing Authority. So hope you guys are ready. They are both rooted in equity. They are almost housing avengers for the city. So whatever questions you have, make sure you ask them today because they are the ones to answer them. Y'all ready?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, good luck. KD, we're out.
Let's go, y'all.
All right.
We are here with the Chief Operating Officer at Atlanta Housing Authority, Terry Lee, as well as Senior Housing Policy Advisor for Mayor Andre Dickens, Joshua Humphreys. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Welcome.
Yeah. How would you define affordable housing for yourself?
Yes, so I think affordable housing, from a technical standpoint, is typically defined as not paying more than 30% of your income. And if you want to think about it, Atlanta has a poverty rate of about 18%. And so that basically means you have folks that are making less than $25,000 a year. If you take that same number, an annual cost would be right around $7,500 for housing, right? Divide that by 12 months, you're looking at a monthly cost of $675. We know, and I can see by the expression on your face, that that's definitely not enough to cover housing here in the city of Atlanta. We know that the average two-bedroom will cost upwards of $1,800. And so when you think about that from an affordability aspect, that's why we have an affordable housing problem, because incomes are not keeping pace with the actual cost of housing.
Mr. Joshua, so how would you today, for like a college student who worked at Publix, how would you make housing affordable to them?
What Terry just mentioned, I think, is key to this question, right? So wages play a significant role in the conversation around housing. The way I think we think about it a lot is trying to increase wages and create good-paying jobs in the city, and at the same time, ensuring that we've got housing available across incomes. And one of the biggest challenges that we're seeing in Atlanta, the city has grown a lot, the region has grown a lot in the last 10 years, and that builds on 50 years of regional growth. But the last 10 years really coming out of the Great Recession, it's a massive challenge that more people are moving in the city than housing stock that exists. And what we're seeing happen is really down the line that think of housing as a game of musical chairs, right? That there are only 9 chairs and there's 10 people. And the person who doesn't get the 10th chair is the one that's the most vulnerable oftentimes, right? So whether they've got their income isn't high enough, or maybe they're a single mom who doesn't know how to take care of childcare costs because childcare costs are expensive, or there's a variety of reasons that could create that type of vulnerability. And I think for us, and really working alongside the Housing Authority and Terry, is thinking, how do we create housing stock that basically adds one more chair to the table, or multiple chairs to the game, so that there's not a game of musical chairs where the most vulnerable residents time and again don't have access to housing, or to Terry's point, end up paying more than they can afford to pay in order to keep housing, right? Because the reality is the majority of residents earning below $75,000 a year in the city, which would fit most Publix employees, right? Mm-hmm. are paying 50, 60, 70% of their income in order to keep housing, right? Which means there's less to go around for when the starter doesn't work on your car anymore, yeah, or when you're trying to cover childcare or what have you, right? And so I think that's the fundamental problem that we're dealing with, is that we don't have enough housing that's available at the price points that Terry's talking about. And the onus is on us to go and really help stabilize that housing market and create more housing across the spectrum, so that whether you're earning $25,000 a year, $75,000 a year, or $150,000 a year, there's not price burden. Because the reality is that we're not building enough housing stock in the entire market, which is creating pressure for everyone. And so when I think about the public's employee, I think about the impact of not having enough homes that are affordable for folks, and then the pressure that creates for those employees.
Okay. How do you build more housing stock and have like development without having gentrification in low income areas?
I think when I think about this, there's a certain element of just kind of basic supply and demand to think about, right? It's like, what type of, like, how much housing is there? Is there enough housing for the number of households in a given area? And when you've got stasis there, then the price changes and increases over time, can happen slowly enough in a way that meets the needs of the residents. What unfortunately happens oftentimes, especially in neighborhoods that are gentrifying, where the rent costs are increasing, that the housing stock available and the new housing stock that comes online do not match the needs of the residents that live there, right? So you'll build, let's say a neighborhood adds 500 housing units into the neighborhood. Most of those housing units are higher cost housing. That's what we're seeing really across the entire region, is that most of the new housing that's coming online is luxury housing. It's high cost housing. It costs a lot to build any new housing generally, but you've got high cost housing. The single family housing that's coming online are 3,000 square foot houses, right? So that's not affordable either, just because it costs a lot of money to build that. And so the biggest challenge I think that we see with neighborhoods that are facing gentrification pressures is that the new housing is not priced at a price point for the residents that need it and enable them to stay in place. And so a lot of the work that we do and really across the affordable housing space is trying to make sure that we have housing that leverages government subsidy, so government investment into the cost of housing to drive that cost down and make the cost more affordable when we're bringing new things online. Another big piece of it when we're thinking about neighborhoods that are facing gentrification pressures is preserving the housing stock we have, right? Oftentimes the older apartment buildings or older single family homes we have in the neighborhood where residents are mm-hmm. living, you know, putting in place measures so that residents can continue to stay there, regardless of if the cost of housing that's coming up around them is higher, that the housing stock is high quality and that the price point is preserved. I think that's really important so that residents have the opportunity to stay in their neighborhood, even if their neighborhood does change.
And I think to add to Josh's point, that's really the key, right? When you think of gentrification, you're looking at the fact that what gentrification really means is that people with higher incomes are moving into a neighborhood. And when people with higher incomes move into a neighborhood, different amenities come, the housing stock, of course, changes, and the prices rise. But the key is making sure you create an environment where existing residents can still stay in the communities that they labored in, right? Making sure that residents that already own their home, that they have resources if necessary improvements need to be made to their properties. If you're living in a house that's called air property, and that's where you may have a number of family members that are actually that actually have an ownership stake, but the deed was never probated, making sure that those families don't lose their properties based upon that. So that's, to me, that's really what's important. When we're going into a neighborhood and we're focusing on how do we provide more affordability, how do we create more housing opportunities, and how do we preserve the existing housing stock, let's also keep in mind, what are the needs of the existing folks that live there? Do they need assistance in improving their homes? Do they need funds to help pay for their property taxes because property taxes are rising? You know, what are those needs, and how can we capture that to wrap our arms around the existing residents?
I think one thing I'd add to this, too, is that in Atlanta, we have a city that's segregated by race and class, and the income disparity is really extreme. And so one of the challenges that we deal with there is that you've got a low income. I mean, Terry described earlier that we've got 18% of the population that lives at or below the poverty line. There are entire neighborhoods where the average median income is at or around the poverty line, right? And so those neighborhoods, residents with higher incomes move into that neighborhood, it can very quickly create price escalations where the price goes up very fast in a shocking way for the residents that have lived there for a long time. And so I think that one of the things that's really important about that is that we create conditions for those residents to be able to stay in there even when that escalation moves really fast.
Also, I just want to go back just a little bit. So who is responsible for addressing affordable housing, and what is the process for making the housing affordable?
I'll start off. The mayor often says that Atlanta is a group project. And on the night that he was actually selected to be the city's 61st mayor, he talked about drawing circles. And when you draw those circles, I think you have to keep in mind who needs to be within that circle in lifting up housing as well as other needs for the residents here within our city. And so from that perspective, I believe all of us are responsible for using whatever resources, capacity, intellect, thought leadership we have at the table to address a crisis that's really our city is combating with its full force. But from a governmental perspective, the city of Atlanta as a whole, through the mayor's leadership, is really setting the stage as how this city should move forward and really address the housing crisis that we're being faced with. I mean, the work that Josh's team is leading is monumental in bringing forth not just the city of Atlanta, but the full force of the faith and credit of the city and its governmental agencies to see how we aggressively address this problem. The mayor, and Josh can speak to this, has established an affordable housing strike force that is literally focused in on how do we create innovative solutions that will serve as change agents and quite honestly do things that we've never seen before here within the city to address affordability so that people can have the opportunity to call Atlanta home.
Affordable housing rose to the top is because it's a core issue that impacts all other aspects of life, right? And so if you don't have quality housing that's got access to fresh food and quality schools, transportation to jobs, then everything starts to frazzle and get desperate. And so for us, housing is a bedrock, a kind of a cornerstone to building a better Atlanta for the residents that live here. And so the mayor took office. He put a goal to create or preserve 20,000 affordable housing units over 8 years. To date, we've brought online just over 3,000 in the first 20 or so months of the administration, with another 5,000 that are under construction right now toward that 20,000 unit goal. To Terry's point, collectively responsible for that, right? And I think the mayor has done a great job of bringing together a coalition of people to advance that, and that includes governmental partners, right? So you know we've got a team in the mayor's office, but there are other agencies that play a key role in this. So Terry's with the Housing Authority, which does a lot of work creating really important and critical low-income housing, very low-income housing. They're the biggest tool to do that. And Terry can talk a little bit more about that if you've got questions about how that works. But it creates month-over-month subsidy to help cover the costs for residents through different types of vouchers that get funding from the federal government and have local subsidy that go into there to ensure that residents at the lowest income levels have access to that. So there's tools that are like that. There are also organizations like Invest Atlanta, which provides front-end subsidy on the construction or the preservation of units, the cost of actually building and ensuring that on the front end to make that viable. And then there is a slew of philanthropic and nonprofit partners, for-profit and nonprofit developers that actually do the building and preserving. And so there's a whole ecosystem, right? I mean, housing is an ecosystem in and of itself. And so that there are a lot of moving pieces to that. And in order to address this need and really stabilize the housing market in a way that that helps the residents most, you need all of those pieces working together. And so that's a big part of the work that we're doing, is trying to get, you know, the various parties all on the same page, all moving forward together. And I think the mayor, to Terry's point, created the Housing Strike Force to do that. It started with bringing together all the public agencies, because you need the funding on the subsidy side, the construction piece of it. You also need the long-term, like month after month after month, subsidy for the lowest income residents of the city and everything in between in order to help make the housing market work for Atlanta residents. And so we have taken that responsibility on ourselves. I don't know if it's who is responsible for it. We have chosen to be responsible for making housing accessible and safe for all Atlanta residents.
Yeah, so you mentioned making housing accessible for all Atlanta residents. Where can they get information if they're having issues with their housing?
So just a couple of weeks ago, we launched the city's first housing help center. And that is currently located downtown in 2 Peachtree, which is another project we can talk about where we're converting an old office tower into housing. But in the interim, in downtown, right on top of Five Point Smarta Station, there is a one-stop shop that really works across all of these different agencies and organizations that I mentioned to help connect residents with those various resources, whether you need a roof repaired and you don't have the funds to help cover the cost for that, or you don't know where you're going to sleep tomorrow night. This is the place that you can come to, and there's a group on the ground that will help connect you with the different teams to get the help you need.
Yeah, I want to go back to housing, the responsibility, and just make sure that we don't leave this conversation understanding that housing really is a fundamental human right.
Yes.
And if you think back to Atlanta's native son, Martin Luther King Jr., he wrote a book back in 1967, may have been his last book, but it was titled, Where Do We Go From Here, Community or Chaos? And to write that book, Martin Luther King actually went to Jamaica. He rented a room in Jamaica, was in complete isolation to really focus on social justice and civil rights needs at that time. And when he talked about housing, he talked about in 1967 that we needed to have a responsibility for providing decent, safe, and affordable housing for people who were economically challenged. In 2023, we're still having the same conversation, right? And so when you think about the longevity of this need, it really speaks to why, you know, Atlanta really is a group project to wrap our arms around our residents, our people who quite honestly want to call Atlanta home but can't afford to call Atlanta home. Or if they're calling Atlanta home, they're having challenges just from that whole decent, safe aspect of making sure that they are in a unit that quite honestly is a livable unit. And so I think we have to look at it as that housing, I 100% agree that housing is the bedrock, but it's the bedrock for creating sustainable solutions for folks to have an economically viable life. And we have to understand that housing is that bedrock, is that product, but the end goal is how do we help people become sustainable, people become experience a level of economic self-sufficiency that quite honestly they would not be able to but for the intervention of some of the public policies we have in place.
Yeah.
And to pull on that thread a little bit more, I, 2 weeks after the mayor took office, he went down and toured a housing development called Forest Cove. And Forest Cove Apartments is a notorious modern-day slum. It's probably the best way to describe the conditions at Forest Cove. Walking around, you'd see big holes in the wall, the exterior wall where a window used to be, and people still living in there. Lack of access to basic plumbing. Reports of kids having their toes chewed on by rats in the middle of the night. I mean, just you wouldn't want anyone to live, even your worst enemy, to live in the kind of conditions like that. And the mayor stepped in and brought us all together and said, we're going to move these residents out of this housing. We're going to find safe and stable housing for them. And over the course of 6 months, we worked to relocate them. We also launched a broader initiative to address that type of substandard housing throughout the city called our Safe and Secure Housing Initiative. I bring it up because these are all interrelated in significant ways, right? If a kid is living in the kind of desperate situation where they don't have access to clean water or a conditioned space, or if there are significant like roach infestation, for instance, right, that you may have that leads to asthma, and then you've got asthma, I mean, you miss school more often than you would have otherwise. And so to Terry's point around economic mobility and opportunity, if you don't have quality housing, then that impacts your ability to get a quality education, which impacts your ability to have economic mobility and get a better job. And so we've got to start at this kind of baseline level of creating quality housing, no matter your income, as we think about building a city that does work for everyone.
What can young people do to help with the Safe and Secure Housing Initiative, or how would I be able to get involved to help and make a difference?
Sure. So the Safe and Secure Housing Initiative, you know, there's two sides of it, the way we think about this. One is around enforcement, right, and really raising the awareness about the substandard conditions. Reality is a lot of residents living in substandard housing don't even know that there is help available, right? And one of the big pieces for us is getting word out. Hey, like, call 311. You've got mold in your apartment. You don't have heat in the middle of winter. You've got a gaping hole that the landlord won't fix. We need to know about it. And so that's one, as far as how young people can be involved, raising that awareness so that we can use the enforcement powers that the city has to stop landlords from making money off of substandard housing. That's one key way you can be involved.
Yeah, I think there's this book called Roxy's Day in Vine City, and it's interesting, and it was actually written by a youth who resides in the Vine City community maybe about 4 or 5 years ago. But she used little dogs as the main character, and there was the main character, Roxy. And Roxy was literally walking through the community, and as she ventured through the community, she first saw needles on the ground, and she saw beer bottles on the ground. Then she walked a little further and she saw needles on the ground. And then she walked a little further and she saw housing that just wasn't in the best shape. And she walked a little further and she saw people sleeping on the ground or on park benches. And what she did was she said, I want my community to be different. And so in order for me to do that, you know, maybe I need to be a voice to understand why these things are happening. So Roxy pulled together all the some residents within the community, some other dogs within the community to kind of say, hey, you know, this is what we're seeing, but what can we do? And in pulling together those individuals or the individual dogs as a part of the book, you had some of the animals that said, nothing will change. You had other dogs that said, yeah, we know something needs to change, but we can't do anything about it. And then you had a core group that said, Roxy, we will join you to help make a change in our neighborhood. And I think that's what young people can do. You can make a decision to become aware, to become informed, and educate yourself on what the system actually can do to help make changes and then be that catalyst for change.
Wow, that's a great analogy. Thank you.
It's a great book. It's only about maybe 10 pages. And it literally is one of the best books I've seen that talk about how a young person can inspire change at the lowest level that will impact the highest level of folks' lives.
And what's the book called again?
Roxy's Day in Vine City.
Okay, thank you.
I'll give a little bit about myself. Unfortunately, some odd years ago, I experienced houselessness, I'll say. I was from house to house, place to place, and I'm better now, but I think I wouldn't want to see that happen to anyone else my age, younger or older. It's not the best situation to be in. It affected me in school, mentally, and I'm glad I'm out of the predicament, but I would hate to ever see that happen to anyone else. So you kind of spoke on it a little bit, but what can young people my age do to push for kind of change and activism for safe and secure housing?
I think this podcast starts it, right? This podcast, again, you know, having a voice is so critically important when we need to make change from a public policy perspective. Being able to talk that is more than just about a unit, but being able to show how being houselessness, and I like that term, really impacted your ability to thrive in school, right? To have access to just the basic amenities that you needed to have an everyday viable living environment. I think that's the first, you know, just telling that story. And then telling that story and aligning it with the direction you think should happen, not just from a governmental level, but most of our corporations. Atlanta is one, is a city that has a large number of top 500, Fortune 500 companies. What are those companies doing from a corporate social responsibility aspect to move forward with not just affordability, but again, social justice mechanisms that can create a level of equity and inclusion that we need here in our city. But I think most importantly is having a voice, having, you know, and using your voice, right? Using your voice to talk about what the landscape was for you, and then also talk about what was the change, right? So if you do a before, after, and then right now today, what has been that change and that difference, and what does stable housing actually do for you?
Thank you.
I know, Ms. Terry, you mentioned Martin Luther King, but who else would you say inspired you all to be in the housing industry or to want to make a difference and help others? Who was your inspiration?
So for me, I'm originally from Grambling, Louisiana. I've been in Atlanta now, actually 19 years this week. And my inspiration actually comes from my mom. You know, I'm a product of affordable housing. I had the privilege of watching my mom, and I say privilege, I didn't understand that then, but I understand now it was a privilege because I had the privilege of watching an African-American woman put her family first and make sure that she did everything she could to provide a stable environment for her kid, for her three kids, so that we, although we were in an environment that was economically depressed, we would never feel like we were in an environment economically depressed. And so watching my mom really is what inspired me to want to make a difference in folks' lives. I think from that, being again from Grambling, Louisiana, one of my, and I didn't understand that she was a mentor then, but one of the mentors in my community would always have a group of children with her every Wednesday and every Sunday. And I could never understand why she would have these kids with her, and she would bring them to church for Bible study or church for service. What I now realize is that she was the CEO or the executive director of the Housing Authority for the city of Grambling, Louisiana. And the kids that she would have it with her were the children that resided in the housing projects. And so she was making an opportunity and introducing them to an environment that they would not have otherwise been introduced to if she didn't take the chance, take the time.
So when I was, before I was doing this work in Atlanta, I spent a little bit of time in New York, and I worked for a local neighborhood organization that worked in New York City public housing. And so organization helped people get jobs and advocated for things like local grocery stores so the residents could get access to fresh food. So I spent a lot of time when I was there knocking on doors, talking one-on-one with residents about what they wanted for their lives and how we could be helpful to do that. Somebody had recommended that I read a book called The Power Broker while I was in New York. And Power Broker is a 1,200-page tome of a book about a guy named Robert Moses. And it's an unlikely person for my answer to your question, but I'll get there in a second. I'm reading this book about this guy named Robert Moses while I'm knocking on doors talking to people in Astoria, Queens. And one day I get to the chapter. Before I get to the chapter, I remember talking to this guy. He was probably 35, and he told me he hadn't been to Manhattan. This is in Queens, so we're on the river. You could literally look over and see the Upper East Side, some of the wealthiest property in the whole world. I hadn't been to Manhattan since my eighth grade field trip to the Natural History Museum. And I started getting more and more stories like this. I'm like, what is going on here? Like, you know, I didn't come from an urban planning background. I was on the ground, like, just talking to people, trying to be helpful. And it was reading this book and realized, oh, this guy, Robert Moses, 75 years ago, displaced low-income black neighborhood in Manhattan, relocated all these residents out to this industrial district in Queens. Had no access to transit, which is vital in New York. There's no bank, no grocery store. School's not great. Not even much other housing, right? And then it was like a light bulb moment for me where I realized, oh, this dude impacted not only the first generation of people who lived here, but now people's grandkids who have lived here, that it cut them off from the economic opportunity of the economic center of the world in New York. And now I'm talking to somebody in their 30s who hadn't been to Manhattan since their eighth grade field trip because it cost them double fare to get there and back, which is more than 1 hour of minimum wage. It was in that moment for me that I realized the decisions that you make at the local level, where housing goes and who lives there, will impact not only today, but the next generation and the generation after that of the city. And so if we can build housing that's actually close to the key amenity that you need for a thriving life, that's near a quality school, or if there's not a quality school there, if you can build the quality school, right, and grocery and access to quality jobs, then you can set people up for success, or you can set them up for failure. And this guy, Robert Moses, had intentionally and in many ways maliciously set up poor black and brown residents of New York City for failure time and time again. Had done that on purpose. And so I was like, that's the game I want to figure out. I want to, like, how do you make those decisions? How do you think about building inclusive neighborhoods that have access to the core amenities that you need to have a quality life and to move that forward? So I started calling everybody I knew in New York and everywhere else and said, how do you do this? How do you pay for housing? Who makes these decisions? Where does the money come from? How does all of this work? And really, I mean, it set me on a trajectory for the job I have now in a lot of ways. And I often think back and remember why I'm doing this. Because if you build that housing, then the guy who hadn't been to Manhattan for 20 years, that's an easier thing if you got better access to jobs and better access to transit, because the housing itself actually sets you up for that type of success if you do it right.
Yeah. Okay.
Is there anything else that you would like to share to the young people listening, or any?
I think, if I could leave you with anything, it's just be the change that you want to see. Right. If you recognize that there's a problem, instead of resting in the problem, be the change and be courageous enough to identify that solution. Even if no one else supports the solution, push it and push it forward in order to make sure that we have a better city, quite honestly, a better society.
Part of why I came back to Atlanta was because I think that Atlanta, there's a spirit in this city that's always striving and always thinking kind of what kind of city do we want to become. I think there's an opportunity here now and into the future to shape it, to put our hands on it, to mold it, to build the best version of Atlanta, the one that creates opportunities where people don't experience houselessness, where residents have access to quality jobs and fresh food access. We're only going to get there if we do it together, and that is an iterative process, and it's going to require all of us.
Yeah, you mentioned kind of the spirit of Atlanta. So what would you guys say you love most about Atlanta?
Just that Atlanta, everything feels possible here, right? I mean, it feels like a city where we have the chance to decide what the future of it is. And that's an undecided thing right now. There's an opportunity right here, right now, in this moment, to be a part of deciding what the next 50 years of Atlanta looks like. And that's what I love about being here.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I had a chance to work on a project called Atlanta City Design, and I was really thinking through what type of city do we want to become. And in understanding what type of city we want to become, what should be the foundational policies that help guide that trajectory, guide that growth. And, the thing that attracted me most to Atlanta was just the fact, to Josh's point, it's a city of possibilities. It's a city of optimism. It's a city of great pride. Being an African-American female, it's a city that, quite honestly, has so many possibilities for us to show us who we can be, so many examples that we can actually have in front of us, showing us that all things are possible.
What is your favorite song by an Atlanta artist?
Well, mine is T.I.
Any song?
Back to your point about, why do I like Atlanta? You can have whatever you like.
Yeah.
That's my song.
I'm going to go with a throwback. I'm going to take Midnight Train to Georgia by Tips. I thought about that song a lot when I was thinking about moving back to Atlanta. So it put its hands around me and pulled me back in.
Thank you guys so much for joining us today.
We enjoyed having you, and we hope to see you soon.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks so much.
This has been another episode of Growing Up ATL, podcast created by your Mayor's ATL Year of the Youth Ambassadors.
Visit us at atlyearoftheyouth.com or follow us on Instagram at ATL Year of the Youth for more information.